Welcome to the Global Tech Leaders Podcast, where we help business leaders and individual contributors with actionable insights to hit their number and figure out the nuances of truly operating a business globally today, squeezing the essence of the lessons learned from the planet's top tech leaders. This is your guide to joining the fast track to global market scaling.
On today's show, we welcome Chris Caulfield, the CRO at Alethion. He commercializes B2B platforms and leads revenue growth, a builder of digital and physical products, delivering computer vision solution to trace premium goods through supply chains. His customers have many names: enterprises, subscribers, developers, and friends. 25 plus year career spans across global orgs, from new IP to that first dollar of sales to 1 billion in plus in ARR business, from SaaS to augmented reality and blockchains included. Of note in particular, he kicked off the Office 365 sales program, driving and delivering $400 million in company growth, which is an early venture into the cloud, and launched a range of SaaS APIs and edge services, including Microsoft Surface Hubs and HoloLens. So a comprehensive career. Welcome, more importantly, to the show, Chris.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I appreciate it, Ross.
Well, tell us a little bit about your journey, if you would. We often ask our guests to kind of tell us a bit about their journey, as it were. Sometimes it's linear, sometimes it's circuitous, and sometimes it's accidental and fortuitous. But what was some of the kind of inflection points you took along that career journey thus far, and kind of what made you to make decisions and take forks in the road, as it were, if you could share with us?
Yeah, of course. I think I might be a bit nostalgic, because in the last 5-6 years, I'm probably repeating some of my first 5-6 years in my career, where I'm in a mix of invention and new tech and new opportunity, new types of customers. Today, I'm working, as you mentioned, very closely in the computer vision field with customers that care to trace their products and find ways to track where they go, who uses them, are they safe, are they correct, are they quality, and that ranges everything from automobile parts to collectibles. And that's really, I think, an interesting collection of tech trends, buying habits, decision makers, and really new markets and new ways to sell. When I first started my career, I was actually a developer working in code and creating new automotive tools, new tools for factories, new tools for insurance companies, essentially helping create automation and helping people work better in B2B scenarios. And when I was really young, I was actually quite fortunate to work very closely in a family business that had machine centers and was very close to process control, including CNC code. So at the time, I didn't know it, but I was certainly destined to be a maker. But today, what that sort of added up to from a new vantage point, having worked at Microsoft and other kind of big enterprises, is I think an appreciation for how hard it is to really help people change in a way that they can trust, in a way that they can see success, and in a way that they can actually hit their own business value or personal value trace that they need. And so for me, working in augmented reality or working in spaces that now we can cleverly call the metaverse or blockchain or all these other new and exciting fields, there's still a lot of really old problems that come to bear about how people want to buy and how they will trade their hard-earned money for your own goods and services. But I think the overall kind of chapters of my career included this kind of these periods of invention where I'm working very closely with product engineers, product management, people that actually make and create directly, and then linking together marketing and access to audiences and linking together the people that'll go to market, the commercial teams that'll make things happen. But I also learned quite a bit about operationalizing those details. I spent about 13 years at Microsoft, which is, you know, among the best in the world as an enterprise to get product market fit right, figure out how to link the product characteristics together in a way that's interesting, and then bring those to people in a reliable and repeatable way, including through, to me, very critically, through partners. Partnerships, we may talk about a bit today, but that's, to me, been an essential part of my learning in terms of being a sales leader is how do you take it take a best use of your own team and mix that with the talents and experiences of others to bring things to life. So yeah, in a nutshell, in a period now, certainly working in a mix of hardware, software, sensors, and mechanical things to help people manage supply chains. But along the way, learn quite a bit about how go-to-markets work, how people want to buy software and services, including cloud services. And then, of course, how do you bring the people together and the cultures together to make that reliable and a repeatable thing over time?
Yep. I suppose one of the things I'm very curious on is obviously you've set up new divisions, you've driven considerable revenue for Microsoft. You spent 13 years there, as you shared. And you're launching new product into the marketplace, obviously with a Microsoft badge behind you. But also I note from your bio, you've taken IP to market and you've driven that first dollar in revenue. What would you say is the contrast, between a new division with a big brand behind you versus going out to the market with maybe a lesser known brand, but some seriously cool tech? I mean, no, I've been a developer myself. I kind of describe myself as a bit of a closet nerd in that regard, but maybe could you compare and contrast some of the challenges around go to market when, you've got big brand tech versus kind of highly sophisticated tech and disruptive tech. What does that contrast look like in your experience?
Yeah, the highly sophisticated tech often is not only sophisticated new tech, it's also quite frequently a new category. And developing a new category is hard. The first people that introduced virtual reality, decades ago, it's only recently that we all sort of speak of it on a daily basis or a weekly or perhaps monthly basis, but it's on the cultural mindset that virtual reality is a thing, and augmented reality and now the metaverse and now new ideas. But it took a long time for the original developers and creators of that type of tech to actually get mindshare and to get people to understand that that's something that could be considered to solve problems or to solve for things like education or entertainment or whatever the use case might be. So I think certainly the really important lessons I've probably am still learning is, when to create a new product and when to create a new category. And if you're doing both of those things, it's a tall order. And sometimes only big companies can really successfully have the staying power to see through, that entirely. Now, sometimes a young company will pull that all together and know how to tell a story for a new category and a new product. So take, for example, the social media companies. They're really the idea of bringing people together for good or bad, but for reasons of communication and reaching people and that are remote and distant. If you take a company like Twitter, nobody had ever thought of really the idea of these, updates and messages in a way that they had. And so they both brought a product and a category together, which turned into obviously a huge platform for the world. And the same is true for, as we speak, these ideas of NFTs and metaverse and all these really bleeding edge things. So there's cases where that can occur, but for the majority of new introductions of products that are going to be in everyday life, from mobile phones to maybe even new ways to track your personal expenses, it's really important as a startup to understand, or a young company to figure out, are you playing in a space where the category is defined or it isn't? And that's one thing that is a huge difference between, how a big company can have the patience to go for years and invest in a category while it's still developing. In my own personal experience, I certainly was part of that. I launched the original sales team for HoloLens at Microsoft, which was and still is a new category. This augmented reality, it was finding its way with use cases. The tech is becoming better and more usable. New versions are being made, but years go by and hundreds of millions or billions of dollars get spent on R&D, and most startups just can't sustain that. So it certainly, I think that's the first thing I check is, is it a category problem or a product problem? And it's a case where you've got to really carefully pick, going into a space that's known or unknown, and your fortunes are going to vary from there.
Very good, Chris. We're going to touch on that in just a moment in terms of kind of how do those things define your go-to-market strategy and how do they inform and help you decide where to place your chips, so to speak. Talk to us a little bit about Lithion. What do they do? Where are you guys at? How are you growing? It seems to me that you would be complementary with the kind of NFTs, and you would help people to at least immutably identify those tokens and kind of and a lot of other things as well. So I'm not going to even attempt to try and explain it and make a balls of it. I'll let you do it properly. What are you guys doing over there at Alithion, and kind of how did you join forces with them, and kind of what's the future looking like?
Right. Yeah. First of all, I have to admit, I've been fortunate enough to fall kind of backwards into some of these hot trends and names. And, I've been working on the metaverse, I suppose, without knowing it for multiple years. And I think there's quite a few people that probably feel the same way, where we now, we might have a name for some of the things that we do, or the blockchain, which has been searching for applications for a long time. And now they're kind of becoming real when it comes to immutable tracing. But that immutable tracing is exactly what we do. A couple of years ago, I had met some of the Alithion team. At the time, I was in Los Angeles, and we'd been taking a family course from the Midwest, where we originally started our family in Chicago area, and then moved to Los Angeles. And we had sort of sought a Pacific Northwest landing at some point, having spent time at Microsoft. We came to appreciate the area, the fresh smell of the evergreen, the technology being developed, and the culture of the kind of the coffee town that Seattle is. But I had met the Alithion team and realized that about 2 years ago, the patent portfolio and the invention that had already been done was just incredible. The company had really invented a way to look at the surface of an object using nothing more than a standard camera and interpret an image of an object. It could be the surface of a automotive part. It could be a passport. It could be a electronic circuit board, or even a collectible playing card. And by looking at that surface, converting an image into statistical information, that information could provide a key to that surface, which was uniquely linked to that surface. In other words, without barcodes or tags or labels or any other modification, an object could tell you what it is. And that was a really amazing aha, and something that actually had been in development for decades by the original founders of the company. But a couple of years ago, what was in place was the tech to make that work, the lab to get it running, and a need to commercialize it. And it was just super fascinating to me, because here was something that was in a way obvious. Of course, we should be able to see an image of an object and identify one object from many thousands or millions. And so take, for example, a aerospace bolt. They may all look the same to you and I. We see a bucket of them, but at a surface level, they have their own micro fissures and casting marks or forging marks and little bit of distinction that will allow them to be differentiated with a camera. And as it turns out, tech in cameras, sensors, cell phones, and the like, they're all now good enough to be able to identify these objects uniquely. And so that really.
How does it do that? Is that through, is it like OCR recognition or how, what is it?
No, it's a conversion of what we see as pixels in a visual image into a statistical map that is a key to that object. So the map itself becomes unique to every object, and every object has a map. We our term for that is called feature print, and it's sort of like the fingerprint on your finger.
Even the exact same object. So if it's like two objects that are exactly the same. So for example, two screws or something that are exactly the same, they will have unique individual keys or maps.
Yeah, that's it. And we could take a currency, a euro coin, whatever's on your desk today. There are probably some things that are very unique that you can tell apart, and then many that are not. But we have one of our partners in Japan, Lynx, which is just a phenomenal group of people. Their standard demo is to take hundreds of pieces of packaged gum that look identical, line them up, and with our technology, each one could be given their own serial number. So that kind of gives you an idea of the sort of impact of.
So what it's like an alphanumeric string, is it? And it's unlimited in terms of the amount of variations that are possible.
Yeah, that's a great interpretation. This is a universal algorithm that can see an object, determine its unique characteristics, and then convert that into a map that is resilient against any others. And that, in that way, one package of gum cannot be the same as another package of gum, because everything ultimately is unique at a close enough level. Now, there's some things that tend to resist our capabilities. If you've got highly reflective glass, for example, or crystal structures, and practically, there's some components that can be difficult to automate. And so many of our customers want to automate this process. But just for the vast majority of everyday things that we care about, from gold bars to automotive transmission gears to collectible watches, these are things that our technology can see in a new way. So this is something that really represented truly a go-to-market problem. How do you take a lab that had created this amazing technology, patented it? In fact, we now have 50 plus patents in the space. And then how do you make that accessible to people? And to me, that's really where my passion is packaging and making product and capabilities accessible to those who need them, especially if they haven't really considered that it was possible before.
Well, the big challenge there, I'd imagine, is that you would kind of, because there's so many applications and use cases, you could be in danger of trying to boil the ocean.
Precisely.
In terms of who you should focus on, and there's so many use cases I would imagine for that technology. Yeah. We can get in a little bit to how do you narrow that down and focus on who you go after. This series really is a CRO focus series where we're shining a light on the role, and we're learning that a CRO is quite an all-round position that directly affects the future success of a company. And the good CROs like you, Chris, need to have vast experience in scaling revenues. They need to be able to manage large sales teams, be well-versed in cross-channel marketing and advertising, and have really excellent communication skills. So no matter how large or small your organization is, today's formula for revenue growth must move beyond the boundaries of the sales division or the sales effort. And everyone in a company needs to be involved in revenue growth, in our view. And someone has to coordinate and lead them. So I guess that someone is you, Chris. So tell us a little bit about your philosophy around the CRO role and what excites you about it.
I think in my experience and people that I know in this role or that have arrived here, you come from one of two ways. Either really good sophistication around how to make deals of a product kind of independent of the product. In other words, people that know how to land goods in the type of customer you care to land goods in. So it could be in enterprise markets, it could be consumer markets, but there's a group of people that come from that world. And there's a group of people that come from the world of making a product and using the product to lead growth. And I think only now discovering that while both are important, I think I've come from the latter world, meaning packaging and making a product accessible is critical to the whole organization, but it's really critical to your customers. I know, and I learned this many ways, including recently, but also over time and even at Microsoft, most customers are not interested in a kit. There's a lot of certainly developers and companies that know when to buy a kit or a set of APIs or a set of tools, but especially when you're forging a new path, I mean, you have a new concept, customers want to see what a finished solution could look like because they don't know how to assemble it themselves. And so much of the work that I have to do to help rally a commercial effort is to make sure that there's a product that exists and it's packaged in such a way that it can be consumed. So for me, I knew full well that when I saw these patents and these demos and the capability Alikon had, it wasn't going to be a matter of, okay, take that and try to put a price tag on it and let's see if we can sell it. You really had to have an interim step. You have to have a platform or some product to represent these capabilities, know its boundaries, know how it's supported, and then know the role for you and your partner. So, quite often what I'll find is that in a new initiative, especially where it could be hardware, software, it could even be apparel, it could be anything where there's a new arrival. The early days are defining what the product is going to be, matching it up against some test customers and seeing how it fits. In our case, Alethion started, and again, I'm going to go back to now, early 2020. It was actually, as I was joining the company, it was engaged working with American Airlines to really solve the problem of lost baggage. As you can imagine, if a product can be identified uniquely, And all sorts of bags are being routed through baggage systems at airports worldwide, but you know, a good 8 or 9% of them always go missing. Well, perhaps our tech could help. And in fact, it really can. But of course, COVID put a real quick stop to that productization because no one was really moving bags around at the rate they were before. I think that's going to come back, but we really had to change the company and refocus those efforts into more of a broader commercial space. And so we took those learnings and started to figure out how to encapsulate what the goodness was of that and put that into a product stack. And some of the first moves I make were to kind of come up with a, not quite a small, medium, large, but something like that to at least provide some boundaries of what a system could look like from Alethion. And this was true whether at was at Microsoft or was prior to Microsoft or after, where I'd work in augmented reality space or work in new kinds of software, including unified communications. I spent quite a bit of time in, so the forerunners to Microsoft Teams or Zoom. But in all those cases, you know, customers say, okay, great. Why should I care about what you do? It's super exciting. But I really learned that there's a big difference between creating a fascination for tech versus creating a buyer. And so to me, being customer driven and getting that buyer first is really about helping them understand your product in a way that they can absorb it. So moving from a bag of patents and statistical algorithms that are incredibly impressive into a SaaS model, that was something that we did. Figure out how to subscribe to our tech, moving from a kind of a tricky hardware kit into more of a reference design that partners could use. That was part of our early steps. And in fact, we've got that available now. Moving from a kind of a loose set of use cases that could apply to any industry into more of a specific type of solution, say for gray market control, that's something that we work in, or anti-counterfeit and product protection, we work in that space as well. Defining those things became some of the earliest work we did. So in many ways, I guess what I'm getting at is often when it seems like it's time to really step on the gas for sales, that may be true, but what you may actually need is a really good effort to get the company rallied around a product set that can be built and expanded through a roadmap over time, as well as more importantly, can be absorbed by your first customer who's buying something in a repeatable way. We all know deep tech and enterprise software, especially and hardware too, it can suffer from these extended pilots where the product is kind of customized in and the next customer is nothing at all like the implementation that came before it. But you really have got to stick to your, your method and have the fortitude to go create a product, test that product and refine that as you're selling the customer and have the patience to see that through, including investor support, because you really don't want to be repeating these one-off, you know, projects in the early days. You've got to get to a product stack that you can hand off. Otherwise, you end up with extremely talented people that are perhaps sort of overqualified and difficult to kind of add to your team, where I kind of notoriously have noticed that a lot of early staff in these projects tend to be very academic, PhD level people. And I think one of my jobs that's just kind of obvious is maybe reduce the number of PhD percentage staff that are on the sales team into people that can be earlier career and maybe work with through a playbook. That's kind of the aim.
Yeah, I think playbook offers focus as well, because in my experience, if you don't do that, it sounds like you're spending quite a bit of time productizing these use cases, and then with a view, obviously, to monetizing in some kind of repeatable fashion. And if you don't do that, the tendency then is you're leaving too much to the buyer, to the customer, to kind of,
and they just won't join all
these. Yeah, exactly. And join all these dots based on kind of your understanding of the possibilities, you know, like there's just so many possibilities, but people just want to know how has this worked, you know, with somebody that looks like us, how has it impacted their organization in a positive way? And what can it potentially do for us without kind of all of the heavy lifting around integrations and, you know, kind of us kind of having to put together the big picture of how this might work, you know?
Yeah,
maybe,
you know,
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Chris.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, all the, I guess the most prominent brands in the world, they all have staff that are paid to go find the next big thing, to go look at what's interesting, maybe put some money towards their own innovation lab. It can be from Airbus to Nike to Ford to BMW to eBay to, I mean, any big brand has people that go out and look to figure out what is going to help us, what's going to keep us ahead, what's going to get us, you know, a step up, and who should we embrace and keep out of our competitors' hands. And that's a difficult a signal to ignore sometimes, especially when you're, you know, early stage and you're looking for clients, but you end up in some of these experimental, you know, places where these big names can tend to pull you off of what you think is your hypothesis for your product and repeatability in their own interests. So you've got to just kind of mind that as well, because you're really looking for those customers you can repeat, not not just kind of warm and friendly engagement with these great companies, but you need ways for them to become paying customers that value your tech, not and value the outcome of your tech rather, versus just valuing what you've invented.
100%. And it's that whole digital experience, or the CX piece around the customer experience. So a lot of technology is designed, obviously, with challenges and problems and end users in mind. But once they start touching it, you could discover new stuff or something new that they want. So it's hugely important that those hypotheses are tested rigorously, so that you have something repeatable. As you said, the worst thing is that you go into somebody and then you start building bespoke solutions that involve.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I mean, I think in I've landed on this term for maybe a couple decades now, but I think, you know, in most cases, it's okay to be novel, but you need to be familiar too. And perhaps you limit the novel, you know, nature of the what you're offering to where the, you know, the business value is, what you do differently than competitors, perhaps the new kind of solutions you can create. And in my case, if I can help a Swiss watchmaker have a better customer relationship because they can link together the provenance of their watch with their packaging, with their dealership. If I can do that, that's where I should be novel and interesting. What I should not be novel about is, how does our software sell? What do the contracts look like for support? Who provides hardware coverage? Who provides support and services periodically to maintain a system? You know, those sorts of things need to be really comfortable to a customer, and really kind of embrace, you know, the way things are where you've got a good infrastructure already. Because I think even no matter how clever the tech is, whether it's NFTs or new ways to, put IoT sensors on agricultural equipment, there's still probably a way commercially to snap to a model that already exists, to be familiar in a way that makes sure a buyer can actually buy from you, and make sure that those things are not where you're spending your time inventing, even though you may have an instinct to invent there as well, especially if you're a very creative company, you've got to resist those urges.
Yeah, it really feels like we're in an OPEX type of economy these days. I mean, you really have to earn it every day, don't you? I noticed a collaboration you did earlier this year with LinkedIn, where you talk about the buyer first mindset. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, I applaud LinkedIn for finding that term and then kind of developing it into their own, I guess, point of view when it comes to what their services do and how they can help. But, buyer first, I think there's, it's actually not that far off from some of the other kind of maybe management concepts that we've seen before, like servant leadership, or, maybe the just cultural, ways to help, bring new employees on board and onboarding employees. You know, to me, it's really this view of a buyer's, journey and absorbing the technology, as you say, on a very metered way. It could be a little bit today. It could be on a huge contract annually. It could be a quarterly review. But, you know, whatever you're doing with your buyer, they're constantly doing the calculus to figure out, what am I exchanging? What am I trading from my side for my suppliers, and what ratios, what percentage goes to this company versus that company? And of course, it's easy to see that happening when you see, let's say, very public government or public sector deals happen in a battle over the, the big suppliers in digital world. It could be a Microsoft versus an Amazon versus an Oracle. In the commercial, let's say, aerospace world, you might see a Boeing and Airbus showdown, that sort of thing. So it's easy to see those, but those happen all the time for smaller vendors as well too. And for a smaller vendor, it's super hard to stay just registered on that kind of list of priority projects. Certainly, if you're kind of only working in the innovation lab space and you're not really getting advocates who are understanding what your capabilities are, and you're not helping them kind of develop their own impact, you're going to fall to the bottom of that list. And so there's a few there's ways to kind of build that into your culture, I think, and great managers figure out how to keep a buyer on top of decision making so that it's not just about this kind of one-off for this particular buyer, but the product is improving as a result. You're including your customer into the improvement cycle. Every company needs to have the voice of their customer land, within their product and engineering teams, for example, and make sure that as a customer is committing to you, you're also asking for time and energy back to, meet with the teams, help people who would not ordinarily be part of a customer conversation understand the impact of their work, and make sure that buyer is kind of always in motion. They're moving to the next thing with you, even as they're landing the first thing that they're doing. And in that way, I mean, the great outcome is I think we probably all agree, is when one of your buyers becomes a hero within their company. I mean, that really is the outcome here, is the people that have invested their time and energy to get to know your capability. And CRO has to look after this for sure. So this is definitely part of this role, is how do you make heroes in your customers? People that wouldn't have succeeded without you, but because of you, they're doing something that can be, on stage at their company, on stage kind of in the market. And of course, these are references that are worth their weight in gold, because they will advocate for you even without your asking. So that kind of be a hero kind of mentality is probably another way to put it. And I think that can be a driver for anybody who's trying to figure this out.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I've always said that it's kind of that trifecta of product development, sales engineering, and the voice of the customer.
Yeah.
And it's that continuous loop, I suppose, between those three key elements. If you can nail that, you're more than halfway on your way. I can tell you that for a fact. Let's talk about go to market a little bit. Going after small clients requires a very different set of skills than selling to the enterprise, for example. And that's why it's so important to select which segments of the market to address and how to go after them. So any GTM strategy really is about directing the allocation of people, money, and time to generate profitable growth from the GTM engine, and kind of to put your company in the best position to win against the competition. So alignment is crucial, and you naturally want to deploy your GTM capital effectively in areas with the highest potential returns, but you can only make so many bets, and you want to make some right ones. How do you do your GTM planning and allocations? Like what are the various steps or components, and who's involved in that?
Yeah, I'm speaking mostly from a perspective of B2B and B2B2C GTM. So in the pure B2C space, I've got some experience, but just for this purpose, I'll talk more about my experience with B2B and kind of enterprise class sales motions.
That'd be really helpful. Thanks.
Yeah, one of the if we kind of think back and think of what's the ideal way to know a GTM is working, maybe just put it that way, it'd be that, the sales management and actually everybody in the company can sit back and look at their sales dashboard or their Excel spreadsheet and just see numbers lighting up. So in other words, it's really, in the end, it's a input output thing. How much energy are you putting in as a sales or commercial team, or even as a company, into customer initiatives, and what are you getting back? And of course, every salesperson at this time of year who's trying to wrap up the year and hit that number for the calendar year anyway, is trying to figure out, how do I get that one more deal across the line? How does something happen? A PO come in that I've been waiting for, that sort of thing. So really, if you just kind of take that to the absurd and say, Every CRO would love to be, you know, doing nothing more than meeting individually with their team, talking, coaching, and meanwhile, the numbers are just lighting up. So how does that happen? Generally speaking, for me, I've found that it's a race to figure out how to make your tech valuable enough that other people want to sell it. I mentioned earlier, that, you know, a really fondness for partnership models. And in most B2B environments, there's just the work is too big to go it alone anyway. You know, my company now, my company previous, the time I spent at Microsoft, Microsoft is a massive partner ecosystem. And I think I learned quite a bit of these chops there. But you've got to figure out how to make your product stack interesting enough and flexible enough that others want to take it up and run with it. I mentioned this great partner.
Was it 100% partner-led model in Microsoft, or was there some kind of direct selling and closing going on as well?
Yeah, the pattern that I became really immersed in and ended up operating and running and learning from just really talented people was this kind of matriculation process where the direct would become the start of the effort to prove out how do you land with a customer? What are the pitfalls? What are the things where maybe you have to have some battles internally with product teams and spirited debates, let's say, about the product working or not. And you've got to get that landed and comfortable so that you can run it. Because if you can't figure out how to sell it direct, it's going to be awfully tough sell to ask a partner to take it on. You know, if you don't see a landed customer. So I think there's this kind of ratio between a direct sales effort versus a partner or an ecosystem led sales effort or a network, you know, sales effort. And that seems to be a really common pattern, no matter how you slice it. Now, everybody may think they've got, you know, specialty group of partners and it's different, but in the end, you are trying to figure out how to lever your own efforts with whatever team size you can muster with those of the broader world. And in my case, you know, as a smaller company, we're based in Seattle. I've got employees in Europe as well, but I don't have people in Japan. And so when I try to do a call and just the simple matter of managing the time zone, how am I going to respond to Japanese customers that are in Japan? Now, I've often seen our Japanese customers so far be generous enough to include people in offices in Silicon Valley, perhaps, but how am I going to have a presence in Japan? Well, I need to have a partner there. And that partner also has to trust that whatever they're representing is reliable and they can be self-sufficient and profitable with it.
So that's let me pause there for a second, just to go back on one of your previous points. It is hugely important that you have the ability, I feel, to find a way through and offer a blueprint to your partner community on how to actually sell, how to navigate that entire customer or buyer lifecycle. The amount of companies I've seen that actually haven't nailed that themselves first, and then they expect a partner community to magically be able to figure out that blueprint for them when those very partners, it's a very competitive environment. They have other stuff they're selling too.
Oh, they do. And no news is bad news from a partner, because that means that your product has sort of fallen down the stack. You may still be on the line card. You may still have a logo on their website, but they found other things that are captivating their customers. So this customer's customer concept, you know, it really is an extension of the buyer first philosophy we were just talking about. But it becomes ever more just crucial when you've got a partner who has to address a world that you have an indirect access to. You can't have a direct access because that kind of blows up the model and you can't afford it. But you need that partner to be equipped and self-sufficient and then also innovate in their own way, you know, safely. You don't want them inadvertently inventing product features you can't support. Yeah. You want them extending it. And that's sometimes easier said than done, because sometimes there's such a pride of ownership with your original company, that your own employer, especially in engineering, where, you know, the idea of a partner fiddling with your, you know, well-crafted software, hardware, whatever it is you sell, that can be rather difficult. But even, you know, even Nike and Adidas figure out how to let third-party printers print, you know, logos and on jerseys and such. So, you know, you've got to find a good way to get that out there. And I often think of that as the white label model as well, where it can be a reseller where someone is actually selling your product direct. But more often for me, I see a lot of success, especially in this new world of mixed digital physical things, where your product is kind of the core of something else somebody can offer in their own brand, in their own way, because nothing seizes attention with a partner as being able to offer something that's branded and can be considered owned rather than just a supplier's product. So we're going to keep seeing more of that.
Very good. Yeah, and there's the red herring as well that, well, you know, what if our direct salespeople and kind of the partners in certain territories and geography start kind of bumping into each other or tripping over each other? My view on that has always been, I think that's a great problem. It means that we've great coverage, right?
Yeah. And it's something to anticipate right away. I think it's, you know, all things being equal, you would much rather take that marginal hit, or I should put it this way, you should take the privilege of sharing some of the results with your partners, yes, given that they're putting in the effort. And you absolutely want to quickly get to the you know, head of that and allow your sales team to be paid on things that partners produce in a clever way. Some of them very directly. Your partner management is critically important. You can't just hope a partner will run on its own. You've got to invest, but you certainly want people to share in that success and make that obvious that why wouldn't I work with a partner rather than something that's a conflict. Great point.
Great. And the so as we round the corner a little bit, we always ask our guests what their superpower is and how has it served, how has it served you personally and the organizations you've worked with. So what do you say, Chris? What's your superpower?
Superpower. I think it's most gratifying to me and probably something I've repeated the most when I can package up people's talents and new technologies, old processes and patterns, and bring them to a customer in a way that's accessible and powerful to them. So, you know, this basically means marshaling the resources of a company in a commercial way to reach a customer. I hesitate to call that product market fit because that's in kind of the world of the sort of CRO and the commercial playbook. There's making a product fit a market as you perceive it, but there's also those winning those first references and getting customers that can grow with you over time through a kernel that is, you know, well considered. So it's a tricky one. Today, you know, the world of kind of buyer first also includes buyers who happen to be perhaps more savvy than you are about what tech they can have access to, how to mix and match things. You know, long gone are the days where when you look for you know, IT services, you go, you know, through a rigid IT chain. Now, some of that still exists in some kind of classic defense and government spaces. But for the most part, you've got buyers who are very educated, who know how to put things together, and they know how to find things generally of interest. And so you have to be quite clever, if not yourself, through the efforts of others to bring together a new idea in a way that can be received well. And like I said, deep tech especially is tricky if you've got to define a new category at the same time. So my job is to find ways to have a great hypothesis of a product that'll fit a customer, but also a hypothesis of how they're not doing that today. And more importantly, how they're going to be able to live with it over time. So yeah, I think my power here, I'll leave it to others to judge if it's super, but the one that's really sort of thrilling for me and I'm constantly learning is packaging the product in a way that can be sold and if sold efficiently through direct work, but also through the efforts of others.
I think it's definitely super. It's crucial as well to the success of any solution and obviously the relative success then of the organization. Well, look, Chris, we've really enjoyed hearing about how important it is to have that right packaging wrapped around an impactful value proposition and a product and to build the right go-to-market then around that to ensure accelerated and repeatable growth for organizations. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with our audience. And we wish you and everybody at Alithion the very, very best in the future. And perhaps we'd have you on the show again at some stage.
I've enjoyed our time. Thanks, John and Ross.
Thank you so much, Chris. Really, really great experiential knowledge. Learned a huge amount today and certainly echo John's sentiment around sharing with our audience. So thank you once again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Global Tech Leaders Podcast, designed for both established and aspiring career-focused tech rock stars, as well as helping leadership figure out how to speak global in today's multicultural world. For further details, check out sf-talent.com.